right, welcome to the Young Turks. We got a hell of a show for you guys today. Cenk Uygur, John Iadarola, lots of drama. We've got a ton of policy for you guys on taxes, budgets, and healthcare.
Nuclear weapons.
How's that for an exciting tease? We have lots of substance for you today.
I've got charts, people.
We have charts and policies. Charts and policies spread over the second hour a little bit too. But second hour, on the other hand, is filled with controversy. And there, there are some parts of me that are in some of the stories. In fact, in a lot of the stories, I'm going to go back to conservative Uygur. Ooh, my conservative side comes out a little bit, and we're going to do a Supreme Court too. Jesus, I'm sad you're going to miss it because it's going to involve skateboarders.
Wait, you're going to come out conservative on that story?
I might throw them under a literal bus.
After they were almost thrown out. Anyway.
Okay. Anyway. Let's see what happens. Okay. Yeah. All right. Fun and exciting for everybody, and hopefully informative. So, what do you got for us first, John?
We got a doozy for you. An update from yesterday's story. Our continuing coverage of the Republican attempt to destroy Obamacare, as we previewed yesterday, the new version of the Republican healthcare bill has now been released. And in this video, we're going to break down what it actually changes from the previous version and what it keeps the same. And then try to get an idea of the likelihood that it will actually be passed. So, a couple of the big picture topics from this new version. The Senate's revised healthcare bill still includes an estimated $657 billion in tax cuts by eliminating the health law's taxes on the medical industry and its individual mandate penalty for not carrying coverage. But it does continue two taxes aimed at wealthy Americans, a 0.9% investment tax and a 3.8% Medicare payroll surtax. So those are two taxes added by the ACA that previously were going to be removed in the earlier version, now will be retained. But what's interesting is that they are doing fewer of the tax cuts than they were before, but most of that money is not then being put back into increasing coverage, lowering deductibles or premiums or anything like that. There are a few things that it does do, and we will give credit to those. The new bill includes a $45 billion program to combat opioid abuse, as well as $70 billion to offset the costs of expensive patients, in addition to some money that was appropriated in the first version of the bill. But the inclusion of these taxes does not appear to lead to any additional funding of the Medicaid program or offset any of the cuts to the tax credits in the individual market. And so the biggest problem then is that the issue a lot of the so-called moderate Republicans had was that this cuts far too much from Medicaid. And it still does that. It doesn't actually change that. The return to the states on Medicaid is going to continue to drop down, eventually kicking many people off. And as a lot of commentators have noted, if the issue was that too many people lost their health insurance under the old bill, this does nothing to fix that.
Yeah. So the developments today did make me question a little bit whether they're actually going to pass it. Because so their cuts to Medicaid continue to be draconian, as John pointed out, $772 billion. That's an enormous number to cut for Medicaid. Now, 20 of the senators, the Republican senators, are in states that have relied on the federal government's increased Medicaid funding under Obamacare. So, for example, Rob Portman from Ohio, Shelley Mary Capito, Shelley Moore Capito, sorry, from West Virginia, they both, all those governors took the Medicaid expansion. So now they're sitting there going, wait, you're going to now kick all those people off of Medicaid? And they're not going to do it immediately, but it begins in 2024. So they're very concerned about that. And I think that we're at the bone here. Like when you hit the bone, you know you've got an issue. So they're going to lose Susan Collins. They've known from day one. She's the main senator from Maine, and she's going to run for governor of Maine. And she says she's going to expand Medicaid if she can into Maine. So she was almost never going to vote for it. Murkowski from Alaska has said no. If they don't increase Medicaid, you know, at least from the first version. I mean, she said, if you're going to eliminate Medicaid expansion, or even if you're going to wind down Medicaid expansion, that's not increasing access. And she has said that was an absolute requirement on her part, was to increase access. There's no way this increases access. Mm-hmm. Well, if you lost those two, you have to hold every single other person. And by the way, they're also pissed that it cuts funding to Planned Parenthood, and they're not in favor of that.
Yeah.
So then you got Capito, you got Heller, you got Portman, you got Hoven from North Dakota. They've all said on the record that they don't want Medicaid cut this much. By the way, they're not really moderates. You could cut Medicaid right up to the bone and they'll say yes, right? Yeah. But now this cuts so much from Medicaid and would devastate so many people in their states that they're now worried, like, we have a limit to how much we can trick people with the money donors give us. Mm-hmm. I think this might be beyond the limit, and hence we will lose our power, we'll lose our seats.
Exactly. I mean, look, they see the polls, they know how unpopular this bill is, and they know that people have been paying a lot of attention to healthcare over the past 8 years or so. It's not going to go away as an issue in a year. And while those who, you know, theoretically are going to support the bill, they during that Senate recess, they're not holding town halls, they're not actually responding to the concerns of their constituents. Some of those who were kind of no votes at this point, or were last week, they did actually meet up with some constituents. Not necessarily at town halls, but there were some like rounds of applause for those who'd said that they were gonna have a no. And so I don't think that they went back, listened to their constituents, and now think, you know what? I think I can support this bill. I think that that's an unlikely result from what they experienced. But that's the side of the so-called moderates. Now, there were others on the opposite side of Republicans who weren't supporting this bill. And so why don't we go through some of their concerns? The biggest policy change that we previewed on the show yesterday is an amendment to allow health insurers to deny coverage based on pre-existing conditions and cover few benefits, basically cutting out those essential benefits, as long as they have one plan available that does cover those things. You would have all sorts of plans that don't essentially provide the coverage that you would think you're getting by paying for health insurance. And that is the Ted Cruz, the Mike Lee thing. So why don't we check in with Ted Cruz and see if he now supports the bill thanks to this amendment.
My central focus from the beginning has been on lowering premiums. The biggest reason so many millions of people are unhappy with Obamacare or suffering under it is that it's made premiums skyrocket. And I think the way we unite our conference, the way we bring Republicans together has always been to focus front and center on lowering premiums. The bill that was announced today includes two critical provisions designed to lower premiums. The first is the Consumer Freedom Amendment, an amendment I introduced that I've been pushing for a long time. Both of those are big deals. Both of those are amendments I introduced, and so I'm encouraged the bill's moving in the right direction. I think we've made very significant progress expanding choices, expanding options, expanding competition, and reducing premiums. That, in my view, was always the most important part of this process.
So what I hear from that is that the conservatives will go along with this, whether it actually accomplished what they wanted or not, that they were able to get enough from the negotiations that they're gonna vote with the bill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, theoretically, look, Ted Cruz this way, he gets to imply that he was the strong conservative that made the bill more of a bastard than it already was, while also setting up its eventual destruction. Because as we've talked about now for weeks, if you do what Ted Cruz and Mike Lee want and you set up these plans that don't actually provide the health insurance benefits to those pre-existing conditions, essential health benefits, you add the caps and all of that, then you are eventually setting up a system where the only people who will go into those now more expensive plans are those who are sicker. And that will eventually create de facto high risk pools, and that will crush the system over time. It will produce the outcome that they've been saying we already have, even though the CBO keeps saying we actually do not. So that's one of the concerns. We also have Rand Paul, which we can go to in just a second.
Yeah, okay, why don't we watch? JR, I want to come to you because you watched all this in a second. Let's watch Rand Paul and then I want to come to you.
Well, unfortunately, the new plan actually doesn't repeal Obamacare. It keeps about half of the Obamacare taxes, keeps most of the Obamacare regulations, keeps most of the Obamacare subsidies, and it creates a giant insurance bailout superfund. And I just can't vote for a bill that creates a $200 billion fund to bail out insurance companies. I'm just not for that. I promise to repeal Obamacare, not to continue Obamacare.
So Rand Paul doesn't seem like he was ever going to vote for this. So I think Collins and Rand Paul are not gettable. So that means they got to hold Murkowski and Heller and all the conservatives. But JR, you watched all the conservatives.
Yeah.
So what's your take? They're going to vote for it, right?
Yeah, because we're also going to get to Shelby as well. You'll see, because it's all based on what McConnell has been saying before. You guys better hurry up and do this with me, or else we're going to have to actually do something like work with people who maybe some of them, every two or three of them, want to do something for real with helping the healthcare system itself. But the full context of what Ted Cruz was saying in 3.5 minutes with those reporters was, I had two things that I wanted. They gave me those two things. Myself and someone else, I forget which senator he mentioned, we headed this commission to change these things with it to get us that direction. Then Mike Lee and I did this. Then you know what else I did? It was me, it was I, it was me, and that guy, and then me, then me again, and then me, and then me.
Ted Cruz. No.
So it was a constant like barrage of himself. So he cares about promoting himself. Because things that he said he wanted to get done, obviously, as we've outlined, isn't going to get done. It's just, in the meantime, it looks like it, so he can look good and come out glowing before the rest of the leaders of this party fall apart, and he tries to stick his head up like, remember I was the leader?
Yeah.
It's all about himself.
I think that, so Rand Paul and Ted Cruz are still angling for running for president at some point. Mm-hmm. And Rand Paul's decided the tack he's going to take is like, I didn't vote for that health care bill, because that thing's going to explode. Now, Rand Paul actually wanted to make it worse.
Yeah.
But that'll get lost in the shuffle. He'll just get to say, I didn't vote for it. And Ted Cruz, he's angling for the donors. Like, hey, donors, you wanted it to be more draconian, and I got it to be slightly more draconian. I didn't really get the things that I want. But remember, when I run for president, my slogan is going to be, I'm with him. Mm-hmm. me. Remember that, okay?
Yeah.
So you want to go to Shelby?
Yeah, why don't we run Shelby?
I do have some problems with this bill. The big taxes are still in there, which I had talked about being a bad part of any bill, a bad part of Obamacare.
But Senator, does that make it a no-go for you then because of those taxes?
No, it doesn't. I'm trying to work to yes. I want to work to yes to where we can salvage something. It won't be everything I wanted, which is a straight out repeal. But if we can get an improvement over what we have now, that will be progress, and we can fight another day. But we've got to fight next week to fight another day.
So are you at yes as this bill stands, Senator?
What now? What you?
Are you at yes? Are you a yes as this bill stands?
You can count me as a yes. I know it's a moving target. Things change. You know, you amend it and they come up with different things. But I've always been a yes. It's better than a no in the status quo, which we are in now, which is horrible.
What?
Oh, I love the rhyme.
Okay, so bottom line is conservatives looks like they're rallying to a yeah. yes. Because if you think about it, man, failure is not a good option for the Republicans. If they say, oh, well, we couldn't repeal Obamacare, that for their base and for their donors, that is a double whammy. Well, now, the problem is once they repeal it and put this in place, that's another kind of whammy. Mm-hmm. But I think that they're also in the middle of hubris. They've been so draconian, they've been so right-wing, mm-hmm. they've been so ruthless for so long, and been able to get away with it by just flooding the airwaves with deceptive mm-hmm. advertising. And Donald Trump just won, so they think we're going to be able to trick them forever, I guess.
Yeah.
So let's pass a bill that Americans will hate. What is it at 19% right now in
exactly,
popularity?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with your evaluation of Shelby. I loved how quickly it went from I want to get to yes. Can I count you as a yes? You can count me as a yes.
Well, there you got there, big guy.
Principles there in Shelby. Ding. Look, I think they're between a rock and a hard place, but I don't think that the rock and the hard place are equally stiff, I guess. Their base theoretically wouldn't like it if they didn't repeal Obamacare. They've been saying they're going to for a really long time, and so conservatives have told themselves for years, obviously it's gotta go, it's terrible. But on the other hand, as you say, if they pass this new bill, it is going to be the most unpopular piece of legislation in our lifetime, so that's gonna hurt you. And the thing is that the situation isn't static over the past 2 years. People's evaluation of the ACA is changing. Now, I don't think it's changing as fast for Republicans as it is for others, but it is more popular than it has been since the very beginning. And that includes a lot of Republicans. And so the penalty that they would face as a party for not repealing it is objectively smaller than it would have seemed a year ago.
Well, you know, so I don't want this thing to pass because all I care about is policy. So, you know, Democrats often are the opposite. What is it going to take for the Democratic Party to win? Yeah. But at the end, you're supposed to pass progressive policy positions. So, and the conservatives, on the other hand, will do anything to pass conservative policy positions because that's what they get paid for. So, so I don't want it to pass. I think it's going to devastate a lot of people. But boy, if it passes politically, I think there could be hell to pay Could,
but it could take a while.
So Heller and Portman and all these folks, Murkowski, Capito in West Virginia, to give you a sense of the devastation here, 1/3 of West Virginia is on Medicaid. 1/3 of the entire state. Not on Medicare, on Medicaid.
Yeah, but after this bill, they won't be.
That's right. And then.
That's not an issue.
Okay, then you want to see some angry folks? I mean, hey, listen.
Yeah.
Release the Kraken and see how it turns out for you.
And again, so I realize that you're doing both. And you're right. Some people only focus on the policy, some people only focus on the politics. And we can take a silver lining in that case of theoretically someday we'll win a Senate seat. But the people who will lose their businesses, the people who will die as a result of this, like those don't go away if you eventually get the Senate seat. And so I think some people are, especially after Trump's election, they're singularly focused on like what effect this will have on a future election. Even not just down to which policies should we pass, but what issues should we talk about in the first place? Let's only talk about things that theoretically voters will care about in 3 years. And look, elections are important, winning elections is super important, but the country and its people are more important. And so we do have to care about the policies that we pursue or deny along the way to those elections.
Yeah, just the last thing on that is that a lot of this stuff doesn't go into effect until 2024. So those results might not be as quick as you think either.
Yeah.
So your political calculation might be off. And once someone dies, you can't undie them.
Yeah.
That's gone.
Especially without health insurance.
Yes. So you can't reverse some of the damage that'll be done by this bill.
Yeah.
So cross your fingers and hope that the Republicans bludgeon themselves politically and can't get it passed.
Yeah. And I'm gonna once again be Debbie midterm downer because I think people need to continually be warned about this. And I warned people before the election about this upcoming midterm election. I think that things look good theoretically for anyone other than a Republican, maybe in the House theoretically, but if you have these ideas that theoretically we can just set fire to everything and win the Senate, please look at the map in 2018. It is terrible for the Democrats. The Republicans have to, it's miraculous how few seats the Republicans have to defend and how few of those will actually be competitive. And I mean competitive under any circumstances with the way things are rigged and suppression and all that. There are gonna be very few opportunities for seats to be flipped. It doesn't mean that it can't happen, but it is as bad as it will be for something like a decade or a decade and a half.
Okay, what's next?
Anyway, okay, a little bit more for you. Today, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced about 400 arrests related to healthcare fraud schemes, totaling over $1.3 billion that were apparently stolen. Among the 412 defendants, 120 were charged with opioid-related crimes. And so that is certainly, considering the epidemic that we're in the middle of, that's the sort of thing you want to see. People who are theoretically getting people addicted unnecessarily, pumping the marketplace full of pills that aren't needed. That can cause a lot of the problems that we're seeing. There are potentially some bad sides to this, but why don't we turn now to the Attorney General who is announcing what's been done.
The Department of Justice, in conjunction with the Department of Health and Human Services, is announcing the largest healthcare fraud takedown operation in American history. The Department of Justice coordinated efforts between our criminal divisions, U.S. Attorney's offices, Health and Human Services, and more than 1,000 state, local, and federal law enforcement agents to charge 412 defendants, including 56 doctors. These defendants have defrauded taxpayers of approximately $1.3 billion. As a result of this operation, 205 healthcare providers are now in the process of being suspended or banned from participation in any federal healthcare programs.
You're the worst.
I'm a bad guy.
Okay, let me give you an idea of some of these schemes that people were eventually arrested for. He talked about doctors. Six of the doctors were charged with operating a scheme in Michigan to prescribe patients with unnecessary opioids, some of which were then sold on the street. We understand that's a big problem. The doctors allegedly billed Medicare for $164 million in false and fraudulent claims. That's a lot of work for six doctors. I mean, no, I know they make a lot of money, but that's more than you would imagine. A clinic in Houston allegedly gave out prescriptions for cash. That's how it works, actually. Officials said one doctor at the clinic provided 12,000 opioid prescriptions for over 2 million illegal painkiller doses.
Wow.
That is insane.
My favorite was some of the doctors wrote so many prescriptions for controlled substances in 1 month than an entire hospital did.
Wow.
That's amazing, man.
One of them wrote so many prescriptions his hand was hurting, he had to take opioids to calm down the pain. A rehab facility for drug addicts in Palm Beach is alleged to have recruited addicts with gift cards, visits to strip clubs, and drugs, and it billed the government for over $58 million in false treatment and tests. And so, like, this is giving an idea, like, a lot of the people arrested did not get those huge sums, obviously. We're talking about $1.3 billion overall, and that's about three clinics did several hundred million of it. But this is obviously a huge issue. This is not going to solve the problem. Even the money that's currently being allocated in what could potentially become the new Senate healthcare bill, if that becomes law, is not enough to by itself solve the problem. But to remind you of the problem, let's bring up this chart that we've shown you several times before on the show. That is the increase in drug overdose deaths. Now, that is, of course, not limited to opioids. That's all drugs, but opioids are an increasing percentage of it. And you see how that is just shooting up. That is a societal problem. That is a problem with regulation of the pharmaceutical industry and doctors and their ability to prescribe things, whether they're actually needed or not. And it is killing tens of thousands of people every single year.
So I remember having covered this a long time ago, and a doctor wrote in that I really like and said, no, doctors wouldn't do this, right? And come on, guys, most doctors, of course, wouldn't do this because there's a lot of different ways to make money, but they mainly, give them the benefit of the doubt, which I think they have earned. They mainly went in to do the right thing and to help people and cure people. But are there bad folks in each profession? Of course. So, you know, when there's this much money to be made, yeah, you're going to find a couple hundred doctors in the country. And in this case, it's 115 doctors, nurses, and other licensed medical professionals who are willing to do the wrong thing for given enough incentive to do so.
Yeah.
So, look, I think the real gateway drug is prescription painkillers. And I think saying marijuana is a gateway drug is completely counterfactual. It's not true. We know what the gateway drug is. And in this case, it is a very clear line from those legal drugs to heroin, because they can't get either the prescriptions filled anymore, or they can't afford it anymore. And heroin's cheaper. And then there's fentanyl, and then you're dead. Having said all of that and putting the spittoon aside, I actually want to give them Sessions here in the Justice Department credit. And Sessions is not a guy I'm awfully fond of, but this is a nice operation. Yeah. And look, this thing kills 59,000 people a year. If any terrorist group killed 59,000 Americans every year, we would invade 17 countries to fight back against it. But in this case, they put 1,000 law enforcement agents on it in 30 different states. So great, at least some sense of proportion for how big the problem is. So a job well done here in getting these arrests.
And hopefully the investment made in getting these 400 people theoretically will stop far more from actually doing these sorts of fraud schemes in the first place. The last comment I want to make is I alluded to the bad side of this. And the bad side is not in who was arrested or anything like that. But Jeff Sessions, while I'm glad, like Cenk, that he's taking this seriously, because far too few people are taking the opioid epidemic seriously, in his extended comments talked a lot about the massive drug epidemic that we have and drug dealers all over the country. And he there is not talking exclusively about opioids. And we know Jeff Sessions' background. We know what he thinks about his recent comments about the DARE program and how that's needed, how we need a new war on drugs. And he's not just talking about prescription painkillers. He wants to go after vigorously legal marijuana, wherever it is, illegal marijuana as well. And that's the sort of thing that unfortunately will get a lot more people arrested, and not people who are defrauding the government of hundreds of millions of dollars, people who are simply smoking a little bit of marijuana. That's who Jeff Sessions is historically. And I'm worried that he could theoretically use this sort of thing to pursue that agenda in the future.
Marijuana has nothing to do with opioids, except for the fact that whenever you legalize marijuana in a state, opioid abuse goes down, because marijuana is a much safer and much more cost-effective alternative to painkillers. So that's part of why the drug companies are the single largest donors to politicians. They need to protect their monopolies. Plus, they need to keep that war on drugs going. Otherwise, their profits are going to go down.
Yeah.
But war on all the wrong kind of drugs. But again, I'm going to go back to giving them credit here, because finally, we're targeting the actual things that are causing the problem, which is the prescriptions drugs in the first place.
Agreed. When we come back from our break, we're going to have an update on the Iran nuclear deal, and Trump is in Paris. We're going to give you all the updates. Stay with us.
All right, back out of Young Turks, Cenk Uygur, John Iadarola. Marissa N writes in on hashtag TYT Live on Twitter. It's no coincidence that the cuts would fully take effect in 2024 when it's past Trump and Pence's years and can blame Democrats. Definitely. But that's an old political trick, and yeah. Democrats do that too.
Could be a big problem for President Trump Jr.
Yeah. All right, we'll save that for later in the show. All right, Gabby Morita says Republicans must believe in alternative Jesus. Infect the sick. I kind of like alternative Jesus. All right, anyway, infect the sick, rob the poor, starve the hungry, worship money, and hate thy neighbor. That's actually almost kind of literally true.
War is peace.
Yeah, hate thy neighbor is Mexico, right? Worship money. I don't have to explain that one, right? Starve the hungry and. Infect the sick.
Take the food stamp money, put it into the wall.
Yeah, Medicaid. Anyway, man. Okay, yeah. Alternative Jesus is a scary dude. I'm a Derpy Panda writes in, the real gateway drug is money. It's addicting and it brings out the worst in humanity. Andrew Jaffe says, you realize this Department of Justice operation must have started under Obama, right? What are you congratulating Sessions for his presence? Well, Andrew, that's a great point, and I thought about making that point on the show, but it didn't make the cut. So it's a good point, but not good enough.
Well, and they do. I mean, this is not like a one-time thing. Every year there are arrests like this, but this is a particularly large number of people.
No, in all kidding aside, Andrew, that's a great point. We don't know for a fact when it started, and so very likely it started under Obama. But things that started under Obama also have been cut off by the Trump administration, including a case in Manhattan about Russian money laundering, which is very interesting. Might save that for another show.
Cenk, you're getting hysterical.
I know I'm hyperventilating, but anyway, so at least they didn't stop it and they brought it, to full execution, and they do deserve some credit for that.
Some, right. But no more. Okay, let's turn to something different. The CBO has finished their initial analysis of Donald Trump's budget proposal from earlier this year, and so far it's looking like the numbers are not quite adding up, both in terms of his claims about how it would cut the deficit and also and whether in the House they'll be able to get enough members of the Freedom Caucus to actually sign on to it. So in this video, we're going to be breaking down both of those. The budget projected, this is under the CBO, that by 2027, the economy would achieve a small budget surplus. I think it was like $17 billion. But according to the CBO, the deficit would remain at $720 billion. So small little rounding error there, almost $1 trillion a year difference, but something to take note of for the future. It said that the average gross domestic product growth over 10 years is currently 1.8%, and that under Mr. Trump's plan, it would be 1.9%, a small raise, so good news for Mr. Trump, but lower than the 3% the administration assumes. And they do just assume it, and they've been saying that throughout the campaign, but I doubt any serious economic minds on the Trump team, if there is one, actually thinks that they can sustain that. I don't know why they would believe they could get to those numbers, but they do need it to make their budget sound plausible. Now, in response to all these numbers, really fast, Mick Mulvaney, the White House budget director, has called for the office's influence to be diminished and said recently that its time had come and gone.
Yeah, so if you're gonna bother bringing facts here, your time is at an end. So look, the reason they promised a 3% is they know that that's not realistic. They promise it so that their numbers will line up, the rich will get their tax cuts. And later when it doesn't happen, they'll blame Obama or Hillary Clinton. Who cares? Trump's full of 1,000 excuses, 1,000,000 excuses.
Yeah.
So you know what the Republicans are doing now? They're like, if you wanna keep talking about this Donald Trump Jr. story, we're gonna restart an investigation on Hillary Clinton. What? She's in the woods, dude. She's totally irrelevant. What a bizarre, spiteful thing to say.
Also, okay.
Yeah, have at it, Hoss. What do we care?
Well, fine, investigate. What's the difference?
Yeah. And by the way, John Quincy Adams, I don't think we forgot what you did. No. Okay.
I love that we're now tracking down, like we're doing hit jobs on failed candidates from the past. Like JR in the meeting is like, Mitt Romney, what's he hiding? Okay, yeah. Al Gore, you bastard, we're coming for you.
Yeah, you think they won't? They will. Anyway, so in this case, this is the thing that they care most about, because that's why the Freedom Caucus is saying Freedom Caucus. What a preposterous name, by the way. Anyway, it's the freedom for the rich to never pay taxes.
Yeah.
So they're saying, look, if we're going to do any kind of budget, my boys, meaning the rich, need tax cuts first.
Yeah.
Okay. So you got to guarantee me tax cuts. I don't care about the budget. I've never cared about the budget deficit. That's all a marketing ploy. So it's all a trick, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, blow $1 trillion hole in it. Who cares?
Yeah.
My donors need their tax cuts. And they need it right now because we're not sure what's going to happen with Trump.
Well, I'm glad that you brought that up. Their lack of concern for what the budget would actually contain, what effect it would have on real Americans. Because earlier today, I saw on Bernie Sanders' Twitter account, he put out a really interesting chart, a scary chart. We should do the scary chart time thing. About Medicaid cuts combined from the little bit of information we have from the budget proposal combined with the Republican Senate healthcare bill. So let's bring this up and show the reduction in Medicaid spending year by year. You're seeing that between 2017 and 2027, it would end up with a more than half of it cut away, 52.2% cut combined in those two proposals. Like just that's just one issue area, but think about the effect that will have in human terms on actual American families.
What you're looking at in that chart is wealth redistribution. The reason that they don't like Medicaid along with Medicare and Social Security, and they call them entitlements. The reason Medicare and Social Security are called entitlements is because you paid into them and hence you are entitled to your own money back when you retire, okay, or when you get above the age of 65. In the case of Medicaid, they're like, oh, like this is just going to the poor. I mean, Social Security and Medicare at least also go to the middle class and the rich, mm-hmm. right? This just goes to the poor. No, we need to take all the money from the poor and redistribute it to the top. So Medicaid is number one on their hit list. So you know what their agenda is, and this is what they've been trying to do since they passed Medicaid over 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Just trying to kill it eventually. It might take a long time, but they can eventually come for it. It's one of the reasons, a small side note, but let's say hypothetically we get lucky and at some point we get single payer across the country. It'll be amazing. A lot of people think that then that's the end of history. It's not the end of history. You can have legalized abortion for 40 years and they'll still try to kill it. You can have Medicaid and Social Security for literally lifetimes and they will still try to kill it. And so even after great success, you do still have to be vigilant. But I want to go over a couple of the numbers that you were alluding to that the Freedom Caucus is going to require in terms of tax cuts, but also cuts in spending. This is from Mark Meadows, chairman of the Freedom Caucus, saying, if a budget is put forward today at $200 billion on mandatory spending and without decisions on tax reform, there would not be enough votes to pass it in the House because of the conservative concerns. They would be willing to tank Trump's budget on those issues. Earlier in the week, the Freedom Caucus said that it would be willing to support a $250 billion package of cuts in exchange for supporting a hike to the nation's borrowing limit. So are they not merciful that they would give that and allow the government to continue to function?
So look, these guys are so draconian and so dysfunctional that I can't, you know I love predictions, but I cannot tell you right now what they're going to pass when it comes to the budget and even on Obamacare. I'm not positive, and let alone anything else. But there is one thing that you could write down in stone. Before Trump leaves, by hook or by crook, they are going to pass the biggest tax cut for the rich and for corporations you have ever seen, that this country has ever seen. That's the one guarantee.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it sets up an awesome battle where someday, theoretically, our progressive champion president is going to have to propose tripling corporate taxes. And I hope that they do at that point to try to right the ship. But imagine how hard that battle is going to be if we allow this to go through.
Because once you cut taxes, the minute you go to raise them back up, they're like, oh my God, they're raising taxes. We knew it. Look at these Democrats. Yeah, well, if you cut them to the bone and we don't have any money to run the government anymore, and we can't put out fires, okay? Well, then we're going to need to raise taxes. Oh my God, you raised taxes.
That's the amazing thing. That's why they want it. When they get this tax cut through, that passes. But so much else that's currently invisible passes. When they pass those tax cuts, they have cut food stamps in a year or in 2 years or in 5 years because it will be needed to balance the budget that they have destroyed. They will cut regulatory spending for the EPA. Any area of government, any social program, any progressive priority you can think about. You won't see it on the day that that tax bill passes, but those are all being cut to the bone when they destroy the federal budget.
Yep.
Anyway, okay, let's take another break.
Yeah.
Okay. So when we come back, we do have, as I said, an update on the Iran nuclear deal, and then we will touch base with what's going on in France in just a few.
That's a fun story. Don't miss it. All right, back on the Young Turks, Cenk and John with you. Politicat writes in, dumpster care is so humanitarian. Unfortunately, I kind of like that term, dumpster care.
Oh, by the way, the most 2017 thing I've seen so far this year is someone on Etsy is selling dumpster fire candles.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty awesome.
That's funny. Samantha Shocker should look into that.
Oh, they're coming for her.
I Am Sock says, you know that we'll be nearing the end of Trump when he starts using federal departments to investigate Rosie O'Donnell. That's such a good point. He's like, distraction, Hillary Clinton didn't work anymore. Let's go to Rosie.
Yeah.
Finally, the Forgotten Arm says, GOP must really rely on screwing over anyone born after 1985. Our generation will be working until the day we die. Well, if things keep going this way, yeah. But there is one other alternative. We vote them the hell out of office.
That's true. But by the way, the prediction about Rosie, I don't think it'll be Rosie, but he talks less about Hillary. He still talks about Hillary all the time. But just, I want to chart month by month the mentions of a couple of key female names. And you better track Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, just see when those numbers start to creep up again.
It's interesting. I think Kamala Harris has an excellent chance of winning the 2020 primaries. I think the establishment will be on her side.
I think in terms of accomplishment, like I like her rhetoric, but I don't know much about, you know,
okay, so
what she really stands for. Everything she's saying is good, yeah. But I think it's way premature.
Okay, so let's leave that. That's
and personally, I'm a rock man. I'm going for the rock. But
okay, that's a huge conversation. Let's leave that aside. But what's interesting is the Republicans are mainly attacking Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren.
Yes.
So those are the two that they apparently fear.
Yes.
So
totally
interesting. Okay. Interesting. All right. So let's go forward.
It's still on the table. Okay. Despite repeatedly condemning the deal as a candidate, Donald Trump is expected to once again certify that Iran is abiding by the requirements of the nuclear deal negotiated under former President Barack Obama. As of right now, under US law, the State Department has to notify Congress every 3 months of Iran's compliance with the deal. The next deadline comes up on Monday, which means that 90 days ago, approximately, he did certify it, even though he spoke out repeatedly against it. I had a file, many pages of him talking about the Iran deal, how bad of a deal it was. I'm not going to read all of that, but I will give you one idea of how much he hates this thing. During a campaign event on September 6, 2016, Trump said, if you take a look at Iran from 4 or 5 years ago, they were dying. They had sanctions, they were being choked to death, and they were dying. They weren't even going to be much of a threat. They didn't have anything going, and now they're a power. Overnight, we've made them a power. He then called the nuclear deal the highest level of incompetence. He also said this, my number one priority is to dismantle the disastrous deal with Iran. I've studied this issue in greater detail than almost anybody.
By that he means he read not one, but two tweets about it.
Yeah.
He's like, who would read past one tweet?
He's read almost 300 characters.
So what I'm greatly amused by is that he is now sanctioned, apparently, in his own words, the highest levels of incompetence. Mm-hmm. So he's like, that highest level of incompetence, kind of love it.
Yeah,
I'm going to roll with it. So he also said he would tear it up on day one. So none of that happened.
So that's good.
Yeah. So this is really good news. So we can't help but make fun of Trump a little bit and tell you that it was another campaign promise that he didn't mean at all. So it's, you know, lie number 1987. But in this case, thanks God. So I love that they're not tearing up the deal, because if then we would have a needless extra conflict in the Middle East. God knows when that would go to war. And right now, Iran is not making nuclear weapons. That deal stopped their nuclear program altogether. They weren't making nuclear weapons anyway, but we took the nuclear energy away, and so they have no chance of ever weaponizing their nuclear program because of that deal. It's one of the biggest accomplishments of Barack Obama, and the fact that they're not tearing that down is good. So if you're wondering why go against your campaign promise, and help Obama's accomplishment. That doesn't seem very Trumpian, at least the latter part. There's a reason why. Iran is actually allied with Russia. So the guy who's blocking tearing up the deal is Rex Tillerson, longtime friends with Vladimir Putin, the guy who wanted to make the $500 billion deal with Russia in the first place when he was CEO of ExxonMobil. So lo and behold, they get into office and they're like, Iran, not so bad. When he was run campaigning, they're the worst of the worst, but we choked them, we almost murdered all them, right? Like, that was like a big thing. Now they're like, oh, Vlad says they're okay. I read two tweets about it. I think we're good.
Well, Tillerson has had positive things to say about the deal lately. It's interesting that the last time it was recertified, he did speak out against Iran and he was not happy with the entire process, although the State Department did apparently think that they were abiding by the deal. And I do have to say that what we heard during the last election from not just Donald Trump, but also Ted Cruz wouldn't stop talking about this deal. The way that they tried to twist ensuring that Iran has virtually no even theoretical capability to weaponize the uranium they have or produce a nuclear weapon, that increased the danger to Israel specifically was this huge mental leap that largely the media never questioned, and they were allowed to just present it as a difference of opinion. You take away their ability to create nukes, well, maybe that makes it less likely they'd have nukes. Maybe it ensures that they will. And Trump repeatedly said that this ensures that they will create nuclear weapons. And he was never really taken into account for it.
All right, last thing on it is that look, there's debate as to whether a deep state exists. So, and the reality is it does, but it's not quite as neat as some people would like to characterize it. Because there's a lot of factions within the US government. And some of them are in charge at different times, and others gain power in other administrations or other times in administrations. So, is there a faction within the US government that is against Iran and Syria and is, I think, concerned about Israel, and Israel is against Iran and Syria? And I think that they're headed in the wrong direction, because if you care about Israel, this is a great deal. The Iran deal is a great deal because it makes sure that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapons program. But they think, for whatever reason in their head, that it's the opposite. So those guys do hate Trump and they hate this Russian connection. And they exist, they're inside the government. Now remember, they lost to Obama too. Obama got the deal done. So he was strong enough, and the factions within government were strong enough to make sure that this deal got put in the first place. If a Republican outside of Trump had won, this deal would be gone. The faction that is what I think people would normally refer to as the deep state, which is only just one faction of the government, hates this deal and would have ripped it up. Trump comes in, he's not with Obama, he's not with what are being called the deep state guys. He's with Vlad, what do you need? And Vlad likes this deal. So the deal is going to stay in place. If Pence becomes president, this deal is goner. So that is one situation where
JR, clip this out. Prediction.
That is one place where having a President Pence will definitely be worse than having a President Trump.
Okay, well, perhaps we'll see. Why don't time is running short. Why don't we have a little bit of fun? Mm-hmm. Kellyanne Conway went on Fox News, I believe it was Sean Hannity last night, to defend Donald Trump Jr. And this time she brought props. Let's watch.
This is how I see it so far. This is to help all the people at home. What's the conclusion? Collusion? No, we don't have that yet. I see illusion and delusion. So just so we're clear, everyone, four words. Conclusion, collusion, no. Illusion, delusion, yes. I just thought we'd have some fun with words, Sesame's Grover word of the day, perhaps, Sean, because you're absolutely right.
What was that? What the hell is going on?
Yeah.
She is the official White House counselor to the president.
Yeah.
Look, she needs a counselor.
So I don't mind doing things that stand out. I remember Tim Russert back in the day with the whiteboard, and we weaved on the whiteboard and stuff. So it's
not against whiteboards.
Yeah. So, and now we're going to meme the hell out of this. The whole internet did, and we'll have fun with it as well. But I want to hit the substance for a second. No, we have collusion. So whether that's a crime is a different issue, really important issue. So the crimes that Donald Trump Jr. could be charged with are campaign finance violations if he took anything of value or he was planning to take anything of value from a foreign source. That would be a crime. There's a potential for a conspiracy if they were planning to take stolen materials, and the Russians would have had almost certainly stolen materials from Hillary Clinton's campaign, not ones that
maybe
they
maybe she gave them some
that were voluntarily given out to them. So those are interesting questions as to whether he committed a criminal act, and let's hope we find out in a trial. Okay, but did he set out to collude with the Russians? That question has been answered by Donald Trump Jr. He released the emails that said, "Hey, Don, I'm going to get you a meeting with Russian government officials who are looking to help your dad's campaign." And he said, "I love it." That is collusion with what he believed to be Russian government officials.
Yeah.
So the issue of collusion is over. But collusion by itself, that's a word. It's not necessarily a crime. So the crime part is interesting, but in terms of you cannot cross that collusion. There was 100% collusion.
It's too late. It's crossed out on her little thing.
Oh,
look at that.
Damn it.
It's you still have illusion and delusion.
Oh, okay.
Which you seem to be in the thick of. Yeah, and they Sean Hannity again, they've all their tiny little addled minds have gotten around this. Well, he didn't get anything. But like we see what his intent was. If the email was, "Hey, I know you don't really like your wife. I got a dude who can help you kill her." And he's like, "Yeah, I'd love that. Let's kill her later in the summer." And then they meet and they don't kill her. The police are still interested in that. I think they still want to investigate what was going on
there. And that is a crime. That is a crime. Just because you didn't execute on it. If you go to rob a bank and the bank's not open, but you took steps with someone else to commit that robbery.
Yeah.
You drove to the bank. You had a gun. You had a bag for the money. You acted in a conspiracy and you are guilty.
Yeah.
And that happens every day in America where just because you didn't finish the robbery doesn't mean that you didn't commit a criminal act. But again, outside of, I can't wait for a judge to decide whether he should go to prison or not. That's going to be fun. But collusion is a word which definitely happened. So anyone who tells you the collusion didn't happen, and including some wonderful progressives, sorry, they're not, it's not accurate. They're 100% wrong. He set out to collude. He went to go collude. He wanted to collude. There's no question about that.
Look, I personally think that her use of those cards, I mean, you could not have put a more persuasive case together using those cards. She put four words in there, but it said so much. But some of the internet thinks that they could use it for better purposes. And so they started a hashtag, I think it was Kelly Cards. And it led to the obvious this. Tomorrow I will regret doing this because of memes. That's true. But just general advice to people, don't hold up pieces of paper on the internet. I'm actually afraid that I might have done it recently. The next one, I love this, always remember Bowling Green.
Oops.
Oops. Then we have this, I totally get this reference, ESPY for best male athlete, Russell Westbrook. I thought I put that in for you guys. I don't know really what that's. I get that it's a sports thing. But anyway, this is to show you that this is outside of just political Twitter now at this point. And then I think there were some that you noticed that you thought was interesting the way where she came out on this.
Yeah. I mean, look, I didn't do this. Kellyanne Conway did this on air. I was a little surprised, but.
Really?
Yeah.
Too strong.
Yeah.
Oh, she's right.
That's the next set of cards she put up. What can you do with
she's
it?
She's right.
But then she wasn't done. She's like wolf-back.com.
That's I was nice
like,
of her.
Wow, at least she wants to get money out of politics.
She cares.
And she said, hey, one more. JusticeDemocrats.com.
Oh, but that's going to hurt the Republicans.
Oh, she has no idea what's coming.
So short-sighted of Kellyanne Conway.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Interesting. An interesting choice on her part.
Yeah, well, I like it.
The only time she's ever been right.
That's true. So I assume we are pushing ahead?
Yes.
Okay, well, I totally lost all my stuff. Okay. Apparently, Donald Trump is a fan of the French president's wife. Let's take a look.
Oh boy. Okay. I am going to have a strange defense of Donald Trump in this story. Okay.
Oh God.
So yeah, if you're Donald Trump, you should be cognizant enough that you have a reputation as a creep and a pervert, that you don't go around complimenting first ladies' appearances when you run into them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not only did you go through the whole grabbing by the da-da-da throughout the whole campaign and all the dozens of allegations, but you just got in trouble like a minute ago for hitting on that Irish reporter in the White House was like, "Oh, come here, well, you're hot. I see why. Oh, she's smiling. She's got a pretty face."
So plus now, the flip side, attacking Mika's appearance and attacking women on their appearance constantly.
Right. So when stop talking about women's appearances, especially if you're you, right? Mm-hmm. Having said that, I don't think he was doing it for that reason here.
I agree.
Okay, I think that what he was trying to do was butter up Macron. And why he's doing that is a more interesting story. Mm-hmm. So now there's a 24-year difference between Macron and his wife. And by the way, same thing for Donald Trump and his wife, except Donald Trump's wife is 24 years younger. Macron's wife is 24 years older. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that somebody told Trump, "Hey, don't get wigged out. His wife is way older than him." Mm-hmm. So when he sees her, there's two possibilities.
Although still fairly young, younger than Donald Trump himself.
I know, but you know him. So there's two possibilities. He sees her and he's like, "Oh, they told me you were older, but you're in great shape. Look at her. She's all right. She's okay." So that's just Donald Trump being an idiot. Okay, I think the second possibility, and maybe I'm giving him too much credit here, is that he's like, no, she's beautiful, she's in good shape. Macron, okay, you're 24 mm-hmm. years old, but you're fine. Look at this, she's hot, okay?
Don't.
So if by itself.
Don't do it. you look lovely, that's fine. Don't say you're in beautiful shape. Don't talk about her shape.
Of course, no, he shouldn't have done it. I know. Ugh. I'm just talking about why he did. Now look, this is gonna lead into an actual important issue. So sometimes we do these stories about the handshakes and stuff and it's fun, right?
We'll get to that.
Yes.
Okay.
But I think there's something important in here too, because listen to Donald Trump's answer when asked about how dangerous Paris is. And how he has said the terrorists had basically taken over and you couldn't go to France or Germany. A reporter asked him about that and his answer is very curious. Watch.
You were implying at the time that Paris was not safe anymore. You've also said that France and Germany are infected by terrorism. And quote, "It's their fault because they let people enter their territory." Those are very strong words. Would you repeat them today? And do you still believe that France is not able to fight terrorism on its own territory? Thank you.
You better let me answer that one first. That's a beauty. He's the one that asked the question. That wasn't even one of my picks. You know what? It's going to be just fine because you have a great president. You have somebody that's going to run this country right. And I would be willing to bet, because I think this is one of the great cities, one of the most beautiful cities in the world. And you have a great leader now. You have a great president. You have a tough president. He's not going to be easy on people that are breaking the laws and people that show this tremendous violence. So I really have a feeling that you're going to have a very, very peaceful and beautiful Paris. And I'm coming back. You better do a good job, please. Otherwise, you're going to make me look very bad.
So that is the nicest he has ever been to a foreign leader, other than the obvious.
Other than one guy we know. Look, that's actually a good pivot on Donald Trump's part, because it's pretty hard to answer in Paris why you thought Paris was uninhabitable earlier. And now he says, "Oh, it's going to be great." He didn't really answer the question of why did you say that and etc. But that's okay. It's a deft answer and a surprising one for Trump. But the real surprising stuff is that Macron was really tough on Trump before, both symbolically and also literally in the policies. But symbolically, he showed him up. He didn't shake his hand at first when they met with world leaders and Trump had called for him to shake his hand first. And then when they finally shook hands in another incident, Macron shook the hell out of his hand and then later bragged that he did it on purpose.
And you could see the close-ups of like Trump's face like.
Yeah. So he had shown up Trump in several different ways. Trump nonetheless goes in with an obvious attempt to make an ally out of him. It's fascinating. No, you got a tough president. Not only is he a good president, he's going to be tough on the terrorists. He does not say that to someone he's not buttering up. And then, "Oh, your wife, she's older, but she's in beautiful shape. Hey, not bad, beautiful. Oh, I like the shape." You know what I'm saying? That's Trump's way of complimenting you. Okay? So now, I wouldn't have even brought up all of that, except for the fact that now all of a sudden there's rumblings that we might get back into the Paris Accord. Mm. Now, it's a little too hopeful.
See, I haven't really heard that.
Okay, it's too hopeful. It's the first time that I heard any hint of it, and I wouldn't have given it any credence except for this interesting display of trying to to accommodate the French, which is totally unexpected from Trump.
It's a thoughtful approach. It's totally possible. I agree, Jing. It could be as simple as this. I looked at the whole presentation. You watch how the pomp and circumstance that they brought him in. They said not many foreign leaders come in and get the greeting that he received. They took him to the tomb of Napoleon, and they took him to all of these exclusive places that they reserve for their closest friends. And it could be as simple as Macron looked at the research, and they were like, "Oh, you be nice to this guy, and he's gonna do everything you want him to. As long as you go, you're the man. You know, you're cool. You're a good guy. Everybody calls you an a-hole. I like you're a good guy." Yeah. Who knows what all the things they said to each other as they walked? No, and he could have been just like, "He likes me. Mm-hmm. Okay, I like him too." He's so simple, and that's what the opposition research talk about. Opposition research is on Trump. Kiss up to him a little bit, and he's going to do whatever you want him to do.
And he will say very nice things about you in public, and so it'll seem like he is conceding to you. It is a perfectly good alternative hypothesis.
There's many things. Who knows?
Well, I guess we'll see. We can check back in like a month and see if there's been any movement on there.
Yes.
We know that this guy, if you insult him, everything he's ever said about you doesn't matter now. He is your worst enemy. On the other hand, you compliment him and he is your best friend. He did that during the primary, flip-flopping with Chris Christie and Kasich and all that. I think the chair was probably right there.
The New York Times once when they had one piece came out about him. He's like, "Oh yeah,
he had a very fair piece.
Very fair piece on me one time."
He used to call into Joe Scarborough's show every day. Remember that?
Yeah. All right, so let's end on a fun note here and look at the more awkward handshakes. Now, again, this is with First Lady of France and Donald Trump.
And you can see the French First Lady, Madame Macron, who are waiting for the U.S. President. Let's take this in for just a second.
He's such a spaz, man.
She's in good shape. Couldn't get her hand away, but she was really fighting. I could feel her strength.
What is wrong with him? Hold on.
It's almost like a zombie. Like, once it's grabbed you, you gotta get out of there. It's not gonna let
true.
You go.
First of all, he knows that he's going to shake their hands. It happens all the time. So it's not even an unprompted thing. But let's see, hypothetically, if you had to have an unprompted handshake, could it not be awkward? Cenk, shake my hand. That's not difficult. That is really not difficult. Okay, yeah. I swear we didn't script that, people.
Okay,
I think Trump should be able to do it.
Now let's do it if I was Donald Trump. Okay.
Oh God! No, don't touch me. Just don't touch me. Sorry, she didn't say that stuff. I was just reading her mind there.
Okay.
Freaking goofball.
I think we're out of time, right?
Yeah, probably.
All right. A second hour is filled with controversies. And I turned back into conservative Cenk on some of the stories, and you'll get mad at me, and it'll be fun. So we'll be right back.